I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, everybody. I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. In this episode, I open up about my own experience with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and it was recorded in two different segments, both of which are included in the episode. The first was actually recorded a couple of years ago with my sister, Sam. And the second part is with a couple friends, Eric Silverberg and Eli Gladstone, who've been on the podcast several times before. And we have a little bit of a roundtable discussion. They listened to the episode with my sister, and then we had a little roundtable to debrief about that previous conversation, which, as I said, was initially recorded in 2019, so a fair bit back. So I just wanted to preface the episode with that so you knew what to expect, that there's two segments within the episode, and I hope you enjoy.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Preconceived. Today we're going to talk about obsessive compulsive disorder, and I'm going to open up about my own experience living with obsessive compulsive disorder since I was a young kid. I was diagnosed at the age of 7. OCD is a term that is commonly thrown around, often used to insinuate that someone is obsessive, neat, and clean, and very particular about the way in which they go about things. But I want to really explore what OCD is. What are obsessions exactly, and what are compulsions, beyond cleanliness and particularity? How does OCD really affect one's mind? How is OCD treated, and how effective are these treatments? I'm going to lean on my own experience with this, but I have brought on a special guest to question me and reverse the roles here a bit. So my sister Sam Mednick, who's an international journalist, is speaking with us today, and she's joining us from South Sudan, where she's doing some journalistic work. Sam, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be on it. It's great to be chatting with you again. We've done a couple of these over the years.
Now, this is not the first podcast we've been on together. When I was a young kid, I think I was like 13 years old. I remember when you were doing exchange in Fiji, I called into your Sambo radio show and tried to surprise you on your own radio show, which who knows what it was about. And we had a conversation then.
It was so nice of you. You called all the way from Canada. It was very kind.
It was a long time ago. And then we've done another podcast probably about 5-6 years back now. We did one on OCD on a podcast that you were running. I've been hesitant to do this episode because it is exposing myself, and I am I have been open about my OCD in the past and spoken about it publicly, but I haven't done it in a while, and this is... I'm always hesitant to do episodes where I'm getting self-indulgent, but I think it's an important topic for people to understand about which many people have preconceptions, and I think it's a topic I can provide a different perspective on. So Sam, you know me very well. You've watched me grow up with OCD. You're one of my main confidants in life, and I thought you'd be a good person to be able to chat with about this, and... So I'll hand over the reins and let you get started in your interrogation of me.
All right. Well, why don't we start with explaining a little bit to people who don't understand what is obsessive compulsive disorder in general, and then we can talk about how it showed up in your life.
All people have thoughts that come into their mind. They come in and they come out. You obsess over them to a degree, but for the most part, you watch your thoughts come into your mind. You might perseverate on them a little bit, and then they just go. And you don't think about it too much. But in OCD, the way I like to think about it is that there's a thought that comes into your mind and you just start obsessing over it and perseverating over it and you just can't get it out of your mind. And in order to get rid of that thought, you then need to perform a compulsion. The obsession really is what triggers the anxiety and the compulsion is what alleviates it. So the person who's experiencing it becomes really anxious and nervous and tense and their autonomic nervous system kind of goes out of whack. And then it's really until you perform that compulsion that the obsessive thought goes away. So, for example, the most classic example, and this is such an oversimplification of OCD, but because most people with OCD suffer in many, many more ways than just hand washing, but somebody gets a thought, for example, in their mind that their hands are dirty, and they just can't get rid of that thought, and they think that they're contaminated and they're infected, and that everything they touch is now going to become infected, and everybody who they encounter and with whom they interact is going to become infected as well. So that's the thought in their mind. That's the obsession. They become absolutely obsessed over it and consistently perseverate over it. That obsession then leads to a lot of anxiety, and then in order to get rid of the anxiety, they need to do a compulsion. And that compulsion in this case would be to wash their hands obsessively, for lack of a better word, but obsessively, and they would wash their hands a bunch of times in order to reduce that thought so that they can finally say, okay, my hands are now clean, and that obsession, I can get it out of my mind. Now, what's interesting about OCD is people who have it, they still have insight into it for the most part. That means that the person who's washing their hands might wash their hands for an hour until their skin is completely excoriated. But while they're doing that, they know somewhere deep down in their mind that it's irrational. They know while they're doing it, on some level, I don't actually need to be doing this. This is nuts. There's just this feeling of something's just not quite right. Despite that insight that there isn't actually anything wrong. And they still need to do that compulsion of washing their hands repeatedly, even if they know that the thought and obsession doesn't actually hold water.
For you, I mean, it completely makes sense. Even though not everyone can relate to that. But for you, how has that showed up in your life? Because it's been a little bit different. You know, you haven't had necessarily the washing hands thing.
Oh, I've had my fair share of hand washing too. It's never been terrible, but I've definitely experienced that aspect of OCD. But to answer your question, for me, it's manifested in a lot of different ways. So the example I just gave is kind of the most basic example you can give that oversimplifies OCD because the types of thoughts that come into people's minds are extremely variable. I was diagnosed when I was about 7. I used to play mini hockey sticks in the basement with our two brothers. It's just a form of hockey where you play with these mini hockey sticks. It's really not that important to the story. But my brothers kept on asking me, our brothers, like, why are you rubbing the walls? And they noticed that I was just rubbing the walls a bunch. And I didn't know why I was rubbing the walls. But eventually, when enough time had passed, they told my parents, like, something's up. It's weird. In the middle of the game, he just keeps on rubbing these walls. So that was one thing, this erratic wall rubbing. Another thing that manifested was I would say sorry a bunch. Now, it's normal for people to feel badly about things and to say sorry. But when I was a kid, I would always be saying sorry for even the smallest things. I'd say sorry to my brothers, to my parents, probably to you. And then the obsession was that I was feeling guilty about something. And then the compulsion was saying sorry. And by saying sorry, I would alleviate that anxiety if I got the validation that it's okay from you guys or from my parents. So that's what eventually brought me to see a psychiatrist and started my journey into OCD. So when I talk about my OCD, there's been three manifestations in which my OCD has presented itself in my life. The first one I personally have found the least distressing, but it still affected my life to a fair degree. So it revolves around organizing and mental checks. So this is similar to the hand washing type thing. So for me, I have to-do lists. The best example I can give was when I was on exchange school in Spain in 2007, and I had a list of things that I had to do mostly just related to schoolwork. So, you know, I think I had finished my homework for the day, but I was just going over, you've done the homework for this class, and this class, and you'll do the rest of your homework tomorrow, and that's fine, and you're done. And everybody has to-do lists, so everybody can relate to this, but OCD is an exaggeration of some normal tendencies. So in this case, even though logically I had known that I had done what was on my to-do list and I could just move on with my day and relax and do whatever, it just didn't sit right for me. And I had this obsession that I needed to keep on going over this to-do list. And despite that insight that I knew that I had pretty much done what I needed to do, I just kept on going over it. So in this case, the obsession was, have you done everything you need to do? And then the compulsion for me was the ritual of saying that, yes, I have done it, and the mental checking and saying out loud that I had finished my work. And then there's this phrase that I would say, and I've said it I've said it thousands of times in my life, but the phrase that I would recite myself was, you've done everything you need to do. That thought is absolutely totally done forever. Never, ever going to think about that thought again. I can relax and enjoy myself for the rest of the day, for the rest of the night, for the rest of the night, for the rest of the day, and forever. Great. And then I would flick my hand, and it needed to be the perfect flick in order to throw that thought into the air because it was gone. Now, I recited that off by heart there, and it sounds completely crazy. It's this routine thing that I would say whenever I had finished a mental checking exercise in my head. While I'm saying it, I know I'm crazy, but I feel like I need to say it regardless. So I would say that phrase a bunch, and then I would do this flicking gesture, and this flicking gesture, I needed to flick it in the exact right mechanism where my hand moved in a precise way. Again, while this is going on, I'm acknowledging that I am being completely irrational and that there is no purpose or sense in anything that I'm doing. But I remember this one day in Spain where I was doing this ritual in my room, and I had done this ritual many times, but this day I spent at least an hour literally just saying to myself, you finished your homework, and I would go through my checklist, then I would follow it up with that phrase, that thought is absolutely totally done forever, never ever going to think about that thought ever again, blah, 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 and then I would flick my hand. And I said that routine probably about over 100 times, even though I knew that I had finished my work and I had nothing left to do. I just had this unease and this anxiety, and I needed to keep on doing it in order to alleviate that anxiety. And the thing with OCD is when you try to alleviate the anxiety, the obsession, by performing the compulsion, the obsession just comes back stronger. So it's counteractive. What you need to do is just sit with that anxiety. What I needed to do was just say, okay, I'm going to sit right now with that uncertainty that maybe I didn't finish all of my to-do list, as opposed to trying to convince myself you've done everything right and doing this illogical pattern of repetitive compulsions. Because by doing those compulsions, it doesn't actually settle the anxiety. In this case, it didn't even settle it momentarily. But I'm sure at the end of that hour, when for some reason my hand flick was sufficient at the end, and I remember my hand was like painful that day because I just kept flicking it, even once I did get some comfort, I'm sure later on that day it came back and I had to do it again. Because the more that you engage in the compulsions, you are giving credence to the obsessions. And by giving credence to the obsessions, they will come back and bother you. So that's the first way that my OCD manifests, in these to-do lists and checking and these repetitive phrases. And it's annoying and it's frustrating, but it's not such a big picture problem for me. I'd rather do that than engage in some of the other forms of OCD I'm going to talk to you about. Do you have any questions about that?
I mean, there's lots of questions about that, but I'm interested in how it's showed up, like how all of that has manifested in terms of you being able to lead a productive life, like in terms of relationships with people. How did you sort of manage to keep it at bay? Because it's a lot in the way that it manifested. What did you do to quell it?
I guess first, maybe it's easier if I then explain the other two ways in which it's manifested mostly in my life.
Yeah.
So the next way I view is more annoying than the first one. And for me, one of the main ways, the second one in which my OCD manifested, has been this feeling of guilt. So me feeling guilty that I've done something wrong. So my OCD centers on morality in a lot of ways. I've done something wrong, maybe it's legitimately wrong, but I'm perseverating on it, or maybe it's really nothing, and most people would say, why are you thinking about that? That was nothing. But I'll just then feel this extreme guilt about it. The best example I can give, I remember when I was at undergraduate university, and I was at Tim Hortons lineup. And for those who aren't Canadian, that's our token Canadian coffee spot. So I was in Tim Hortons lineup, and there were two cashiers, and a white cashier and a black cashier both opened up at the exact same time, and I went to the white cashier. I don't know why I went to the White Cashier. I think they probably opened up literally like a millisecond earlier. Rest of the day, thought goes into my head, you're a racist. You went to the White Cashier instead of the Black Cashier. You're a racist. You're a bad person. So then, that's the obsession. And then the compulsion is, I would first go over my head, no, you didn't, you're not racist. The reason you went to the White Cashier first was because she opened up like half a second earlier, and even if they opened up at the same time, you had to pick one. It doesn't mean you're racist because you went to the white one. And then after that, if I could get some sense of calm that I had rationally justified why I went to the White Cashier, then I would say again, okay, great, that thought is absolutely totally done forever, blah, 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 and I'd do my flick of the hand. That would probably give me relief from the anxiety for maybe a few minutes, and then I'd have to do it again, and I'd have to do it again, and I'd have to do it again, and then maybe I'd go about my day, and it would just, this nagging thought that I had something on my mind that I was a bad person and I needed to go back and rationalize and continuously do this compulsion to get rid of that anxiety. The problem is it often wouldn't work, and then I would need to resort to the option of going to somebody to ask for validation. And that person has been our mom for a lot of my life, or for most of my life. And we'll talk about how there's problems there, but our mom is super supportive, and she's been instrumental in helping me get better with my OCD, and I don't know where I would be without her. But I would then call her and say, listen, this is what happened, please tell me I'm not a bad person, can you provide me that validation? And I would need her to say, Zale, don't worry, it's okay, you didn't do anything wrong, this is your OCD, this isn't you. And then finally that would quell the anxiety, and that would finally stop the emotion. The problem that we learned years later when I was going through cognitive behavioral therapy is that's actually the wrong approach, because by her validating me and giving me reassurance, I'm not actually dealing with the anxiety. So in the short term, yes, it would help, but in the long term, I became reliant on my mom, and I became reliant on several people for validation and affirmation throughout my life to tell me, no, you don't need to feel guilty about something. But I did not develop the coping mechanisms to just live with that anxiety, which is what you're supposed to do, live with that anxiety. Yes, you are a bad person, Zale. What if you are? What if you are racist? What if you did go see that white cashier because you didn't want to see that black cashier? That's what I needed to be doing. I needed to be sitting with that obsession, but not engaging in the compulsions. I needed to allow the anxiety to manifest and just watch it pass, as opposed to going to somebody else to help relieve it. But from my mom's perspective, first of all, we didn't know exactly how OCD worked. I was getting treatment, but for whatever reason, with all the therapists I'd seen, and I've seen many therapists since I was like 7 or 8 years old, this had never really been explained to us. But in those moments, from my mom's perspective, I am just so like 11 out of 10 anxious, and all I need is just somebody to tell me that it's okay and to calm down. So that's what that guilt one is like. Another common example, which people can probably relate to a little bit more, is if I had a conversation with somebody and maybe I felt like I came across as a little bit rude. Maybe I did have a bit of a tone, but probably I didn't most of the time, and it was just nothing. And then in my mind, I would go back to it and think, did I do something wrong? And then the compulsion would be convincing myself I didn't do something wrong, or a compulsion would actually just be going up to the person and apologizing, like overly apologizing. And some of my closer friends probably do recognize this, that I used to say sorry a lot for things. And that was probably a way of me getting them to say, it's okay, you didn't do anything wrong, and that being the validation that would then loosen the grip of my anxiety. So in all of these cases, still deep down, you know you didn't do anything wrong, but it's that doubt, it's that uncertainty that maybe you did do something wrong. Maybe you did. And even though your insight and your logic is telling you, no, you didn't do anything wrong, it's that doubt and it's that uncertainty that just keeps the OCD alive. And OCD is called the doubting disease, and that's why, because you doubt things and you question reality.
I just like that you said it's called the doubting disease. I don't know if I'd heard that before. I think that's very interesting and kind of sums it up for, not sums it up, but it explains it for people in a very easy to understand way, because I think everyone can relate to having doubts about things.
Exactly. And everybody has doubts about things. And again, I'm going to stress this throughout the episode here. I don't have issue with people saying, oh yeah, like I can relate to that, I have OCD-like tendencies. That's the point. We all do have OCD-like tendencies. When we're referring to true obsessive compulsive disorder, we're talking about when it really is significant to the point where it affects somebody's life. But to get back to what you said about the doubting disease, in terms of the doubting disease, the last way my OCD has manifested, the third way in my life has been in terms of things like doubt and indecision. And here's where I'm probably a little bit insecure about my OCD, because I say that and I'm a doctor and I'm aware that people might look at me and say, oh, he's indecisive and he's uncertain if he's a doctor. How does he make decisions? That was one of my hesitations of doing this episode, because professionally, I don't want people to think that. And the reality is, I am lucky that that's not the case. My indecision has never manifested around work, because my OCD has actually manifested in making sure I was very rigid about my studying and my work. And it was obsessed with the idea of being perfect with my endeavors at school and at work. So it has never affected my ability to make decisions at work clinically. So I'm saying that because I don't want people listening to think that as a doctor, I'm indecisive, and that's something I'm insecure that people might think that. And I wish I didn't feel that I was insecure about that, but I guess I do feel the need to justify that. And that's the reality. So the third way my OCD manifests really embodies that idea of the doubting disease. And this is an element that didn't really affect me in my life until life became more complicated, which is normal as you get older and life presents itself with life. And it is harder because there are more decisions to make and there's more at stake. Let's take relationships and jobs, for example. Those are some of the biggest decisions we make in our lives. And it's normal for everybody. Everybody listening to this has questioned their relationships before while they're dating, and has questioned their jobs and their career paths and major decisions they want to make in their lives. The problem with these major life decisions is there are no objective right decisions. And the second aspect is the constancy with which they can intrude in your thoughts, because they're normal parts of your everyday life. They're not distinct events that you can move past from. In terms of the objectivity, everybody struggles with these things. Everybody questions the relationship they're in. Everybody dates and all that. But in OCD, there's this whole other level of doubt where you really can't trust your gut. My psychologist put it really well once. He said, you can't trust your gut with these kinds of things, because there are two voices in your head. There's the OCD voice telling you always doubt, doubt, doubt. There's your own voice saying, yeah, I'm happy in the path I've chosen. But then your OCD voice will say, no, are you happy? Could it be better? Are you sure? So regardless how certain you become with whatever decision you make in terms of a relationship, for example, there's always going to be that OCD voice. Regardless how amazing your relationship is, if it's the perfect relationship for you, that OCD voice will always tell you, is it? Is it? Are you sure? Are you in the wrong relationship? Should you look more? Or with a job, are you sure you want to be a doctor? Are you sure you want to continue the path you're going down? Or are you making a mistake? Is this a huge mistake in your life and you're going to look back and regret it in years? Regardless how certain you are that you have chosen a path that fits with your values and that fits with your interest, your OCD will jump onto these things and latch onto it, and it's a breeding ground, festering ground for your OCD. And that's the tough thing about it, because there is no objective answer. So it's not like one of those examples where with contamination, you can logically kind of look at the general public who will tell you, no, listen, this is in your head. You're not contaminated. Or with that example of you spoke to that person rudely, you can go up to that person and ask them, did I speak to you rudely? And they'll say, no, nothing's wrong at all. Those things are discrete events. With relationships, there is no objective answer. With jobs and big life decisions, there is no objective answer. So OCD, in its search for perfection and its search for certainty, is never going to get it, because there is no certainty with those things. That's just not how life works. And compounding that is the consistent presence of those things. So when you're in a job, when you're in a relationship, those are just the two easiest examples to use. When you're in those, they're ever present. When you're in a relationship, you're in it 24/7. When you have pursued a career, you're in that 24/7. So there's constant triggers for it, and it's a constant presence in your life that is going to lead to significant anxiety and doubt. So I find these just the toughest things to grapple with, because there are no answers to it, and it's not as simple as going to somebody for reassurance, or the insight isn't quite as there, because you see people who struggle with these things who don't have OCD. So you say, well, is this just a normal human struggle that I'm having, or is it an OCD struggle that I'm having? And it's impossible to separate them. It's impossible to separate the two and know what's my OCD and what's me. And at a certain point, you just have to accept you're going to feel uncertainty about these things. But the anxiety that it causes is at a whole different level than the anxiety that the previous manifestations of my OCD have caused me. And I should say, I'm really lucky now that I'm with a girlfriend who I have a lot of confidence in our relationship with, and she's amazing. And it's an example where I do think it's the best relationship I could have. But my doubts and hesitations are something that my girlfriend and I have had to work through. But I'm really lucky that I've finally gotten to a place where I have accepted where I'm at. And there's a contentment and appreciation for the relationship that I have. And I'm really lucky for that. But these are the kinds of things that are the most challenging for OCD. So yeah, so those are the three domains of OCD that personally have affected me.
It sounds exhausting. It sounds very tiring. Like your mind is constantly on, you're constantly doubting, questioning everything. How do you stop from getting mentally exhausted, and how do you work with it?
Oh my God. Yeah, it is exhausting. And I'm not trying to paint a pity party for myself. That's the last thing I'm trying to do here. I'm just trying to shed light on OCD and what it is, but it can be really exhausting. My OCD is relatively under control now, but like you said, even if it wasn't under control, most people who know me wouldn't even know I have any component of OCD because I'm good at hiding it for the most part. Most people don't see it. The hours in which I'm perseverating, I'm often doing in privacy or at home. I mean, in the past when my OCD's been bad, I would just do it on the street, and you see people talking to themselves sometimes and you're like, what is going on with them? I would do that. If I wasn't around people I knew and I didn't care if somebody saw me, I would mutter under my breath sometimes, because even though I looked weird to people, the level of anxiety that I was trying to extinguish was so high that I just said, screw it. I'll talk out loud in front of people quietly. And even if somebody thinks I'm nuts, I'd rather do that. I'd rather have that perception of me than deal with this anxiety for 1 second. It can be absolutely exhausting, though. And I get a lot of headaches, and I think that's because my mind is just constantly running, and it's tough to find peace of mind. And like I said, everybody has thoughts in their heads. But for me, the thought comes into my head, and whereas I wish, like most people, I could let that thought just pass by, like I kind of refer to it like a floating cloud, and just watch it pass by. I can't, and I sit in that cloud, and I go over and over and over and over things. And the worst thing is when I'm going over it, and then when I'm doing those mental exercises, that, as I explained before, that is what's actually causing my obsessions to come back more, because that's the absolute wrong thing you should be doing with OCD. I should let those clouds, those bubbles of anxiety pass by me and just accept the anxiety, and it will pass. And that is the strategy which is best suited towards not allowing the anxiety to continuously come back.
Well, how, but you mentioned that your doctor, your therapist said, you know, you can't trust your gut. So how do you navigate that in life? How do you make decisions? What is that based on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's something I struggle with. In terms of not being able to trust my gut, it's accepting imperfection. It's accepting uncertainty. It's me saying, yeah, I am never going to have full certainty over some of these decisions in my life. And I need to accept that, because searching for certainty, searching for perfection and complete clarity, I will not get it. Again, people can relate to this. Most people probably acknowledge that yeah, I'm 95% certain with my decision, but I'm not okay with that, but I need to be okay with that. And I need to accept that, as opposed to trying to find the certainty. And then beyond that, there's all the treatments that I've explored, which have helped me manage my OCD in general, like medications, for example. I've been on medication since I was 8 or 9. For a long time, I didn't take them religiously. I don't know why I didn't take them religiously, but for the past couple of years, is the first time I've really been on my medications consistently, more than I've been any other part during my life. And they're not perfect. I absolutely have side effects from it. I feel an emotional numbing, which has benefits because it reduces my anxiety, but also it makes me more numb to things. But the reality is, while I'm on the medications, I feel them working. I do feel a quelling of those mental processes. I feel that my mind is not racing 100 miles per hour all the time. And when I do have a trigger, my OCD, it isn't as active as it was. It's easier for me to stop a cycle of OCD and to allow my insight to take over the compulsions. Beyond medication, I've seen a lot of therapists over the years. A lot of the strategies are based on cognitive behavioral therapy, where you just sit with that anxiety. So that racist anxiety, for example, again, as opposed to getting the reassurance, the right thing to do is just sit with that anxiety, let it heighten, and then eventually it will come down. It will eventually reach its boiling point and come down, but you just need to do that. Now, it's easy to say, okay, then just do that. But when the anxiety is so, so high, it's tough to sit with it. It's impossible to sit with it sometimes. So do I still go to my mom for reassurance now sometimes as a 32-year-old guy? Yeah, I do, occasionally. And I try my best not to, and I'm much better than I was. But sometimes I just need another voice because I'm not strong enough currently to stop the process of my thoughts on my own. Other things I've done, I've had talk therapy, which is just more of sitting down with a psychiatrist or a psychologist and just chatting about things. All these things work together. I'm doing a lot better, and I think the medications is a big piece of that, but I'm doing a lot better, and I'm always still looking for ways to quiet my mind. But the reality is I'm always going to have OCD, and that's something I need to accept.
On the podcast that I host, a lot of times, it's a podcast about happiness, and people say that there's not necessarily a thing as mental health. That it's not that they don't believe in it, but that it's surmountable, and that if people make a decision to be happy, no matter what's wrong with you, that you should be happy and you should be fine, and you can overcome any mental health issue, not necessarily needing medicine and not necessarily labeling anything at all. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, to be completely honest and blunt, it's just not true. Depression, for example. Depression is probably the easiest example where you see somebody who's sad and you're like, okay, I've been bad. I've been sad before too. Why can't you just get up and deal with it like I did? Why can't that person just kind of pick themselves up and get it together? But that's not how mental illness works. There's a chemical imbalance in your brain. Unfortunately, it's not like diabetes where, I'm not comparing the two and saying one's worse than the other at all, but it's not like diabetes where you can get a glucose test which validates for you, yeah, your glucose is out of control. In these mental illnesses, there is a chemical imbalance in your brain, and there are processes going on when I have my OCD cycles going on, or when somebody has a schizophrenic episode going on, or when somebody's depressed. And for my OCD, for people who say it's not real, I know it's real. Because that's going to convince somebody. But I feel those chemical processes working in my mind. I do. And especially because I have the insight to know while they're going on that they're ridiculous. So back to depression, to say that people should just push themselves to be happy. And if you think about happiness, you'll be happy. It oversimplifies the mind and it oversimplifies life. And I think it invalidates and diminishes so many people's experiences in life who've had mental illness. And it really just isn't that simple. And I'm somebody who's tried really hard in my life to be happy. I really have. But on some level, the best thing for me to do is just accept that we're all different. And the way my body, my biology, my brain is, maybe I'm not going to ever reach that happiness that somebody else has. And the worst thing for me to do is compare my life and my level of happiness to somebody else's level of happiness, because we're just built differently and my chemicals are differently. And in fact, one of the best things I could probably do is accept that I'm not going to be as happy as I wish I could be. And my anxiety is always going to be there. It's not going to go away. Not all diseases are curable. Some are just treatable. And anxiety currently is one of those. I am not going to get rid of my anxiety. And the more I just come to accept that, that's probably one of the better things in the long run for my actual happiness.
And so what about some positives that have resulted from OCD? How has it positively influenced your life?
I think the strength of it is that it's made me a more empathetic person to other people. It's made me a deeper thinker for sure. I think I look at life a lot. I think that when you're brought into a dark place in your mind, a lot of the time it's inevitable that you're going to be a bit more empathetic to other people. And I'm not saying I'm the most empathetic person out there. I'm not trying to pat my own back by any means, but it does make me understand people and more want to give people the benefit of the doubt. And it makes me a deeper thinker about life, about relationships and all that important stuff. So it's tough for me to separate who I am versus which part of it is my OCD. If I could distinguish them perfectly, then I probably wouldn't suffer from OCD as much, but they're so intertwined. But yeah, obviously positives have come out of it.
I feel like it's like someone saying to a twin, what's it like being a twin? And their answer always is, well, I don't know. I don't know it any other way.
Yeah.
Well, in our last couple of minutes, Dale, then what would you like to leave people with? What do you think is important for people to know, if you sort of want them to have one takeaway after listening to this show? For people who aren't necessarily struggling with OCD, maybe people who are, live with someone who has OCD, or what can they do?
For people who have OCD, I think it's really important to see somebody, to see a psychiatrist or psychologist to talk about it and get some clarity on it. I'm talking about my OCD experience, and everybody's manifests in a different way. I think some of the general threads are anxiety, doubt, indecision, the search for perfection in the way your thoughts are and in your life, and when you do something that you feel is imperfect, beating yourself up about it, and then getting stuck in those patterns. But I think it's important to see somebody, because listen, my OCD is reasonably treated. It's not perfectly treated, but it's reasonably treated. I'm really grateful and lucky that I have had such a supportive family, and that I've had many psychiatrists and psychologists over the years, some of whom have been more effective than others for me, just because of their styles and personality have resonated more with me. The medication stigma that's out there, I can speak and say, listen, as a doctor and as a person who's done this, there's nothing wrong with medications. They've helped me. I'm not saying you need to be on medications, and I'm not saying medications don't have their downsides. And I'm also not saying the medications that we have right now are right. There's experimentation with a lot of other types of medications that might become mainstream soon. Things like ketamine, things like hallucinogenics, and there already is a lot of stigma about those. So I'm not saying that SSRIs, like the serotonin reuptake inhibitors that I'm on, is the only medication that works. But in general, the idea of doing something to change your biochemistry, I think there's merit in that. It's a medical condition, and it's tougher to see than a lot of things. It's not like arthritis, where you can take an x-ray and you can look at the joint and say, yeah, that's arthritic. It's not as easy. It's not. It's not as easy to conceptualize as that, but it is real. So people really do need to get help. It is a real thing. That's my point. In regards to other people who are living with people with OCD, the best thing is to just be supportive. Even if you can't understand what they're feeling, just try your best to understand what they're feeling. And if you can't, then just acknowledge that you can't understand how they're feeling, but that you wish that you could. Like I said, my mom and dad have been so supportive in my life, our mom and dad. And what my mom used to do is give me that reassurance, which we realized in later years wasn't good, because that reassurance was something I became reliant on. But in recent years, what I've said to her when she's asked, what should I do when you come to me? Because I don't want to enable that OCD. I've said, you know what helps? If you just say, I can't reassure you, but I'm here for you, I love you, and I'm feeling for you right now. And even something simple as that goes a really far way for me. It's not simple.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, actually, it's important and it goes a long way. Knowing that somebody is there for me and knowing that people are wanting to support me.
Well, I think that's solid advice on both sides. Well, is there anything else you want to say you want to leave people with?
No, I think I'm good. I think I'm all OCD'd out, you know?
I think it's great how open you are about it and how much you talk about it. And I know it's part of your life, but not everyone is so open and forthcoming about things that they deal with. It's not easy. And so I've always really admired you for that. Thank you again for having me on the podcast. It's a great podcast, and I encourage everyone to not only listen, but to also subscribe.
So thank you so much to my sister, Sam, for joining me for that segment of the podcast. That was recorded in 2019, so quite a long time ago. And now we will segue into the next segment of the podcast, which was recorded just a couple of weeks ago with Eric Silverberg and Eli Gladstone, to debrief about the prior conversation and more fun OCD stuff. Enjoy.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Anyhow, without further ado, I'm going to hand the reins over to Eric and Eli, and we're going to have a little roundtable discussion on OCD and chat a little bit more about what makes me a little screwed up, you know?
Yeah, let's do it. I figured a good place to start would be.
Aren't you excited? This is your fifth time. Let's get this big reunion. A little more excitement.
Oh, you want a little more excitement for me? I can do excitement if you want, pal, but I'm not sure you want me to go that far.
There we go. That's all I needed.
Hey, okay, good. We're ready to go.
Eric is never running low on excitement.
No, I was trying to keep things calm, cool, and collected. But if you want excited, I'll bring you this version of me. All right? You happy now?
I got my fill.
Okay. Back to this version of Eric.
Yeah. Let's talk sadly because we're talking about psychiatric problems here.
So, Zail, I know behind the scenes that you were hesitant to do podcasts about this. Are you cool to walk us through what was, you know, going through your head and what those hesitations were? Because in my mind, I mean, I think that this would probably be very helpful to a lot of people and at the very least fascinating to other people. So what was your hesitation about releasing something like this? Obviously, there's a vulnerability that comes with it, but are you comfortable talking about what that experience was like for you and whether or not you're going to release these podcasts that talk about your OCD?
Yeah, there's a few things that went into play. One actually fits in with my OCD. One reason I didn't do it is because my OCD, I was worried and still am, is telling me, what are your true motivations for releasing this? Are you releasing this so that people will feel bad for you? Or people will look at your quote unquote sob story and be like, oh, that's great, you're doing it. And to me, that's not a reason to do it. Logically, I don't think that's why I'm doing it. I know that's not why I'm doing it, but that's a thought that's an obsession that got into my head. Why are you?
Heard you, I think, a number of times already so far in this podcast, you know, apologizing for being self-indulgent, which to me and Eli, I'm pretty sure I can speak on behalf of both of us, you haven't been at all. But that compulsion and not wanting to be self-indulgent and apologizing for it, that has literally manifested even on this podcast right now.
Exactly. And I hadn't thought about that until you just asked the question. But that's an example of the guilt. And then when I release this podcast, there will probably be some guilt. Why did you release that? Did you release that for attention? What was the purpose of that? Does that make you a bad person? That was part of it. Another part of it was, I think that I try to make the podcast, I guess it's similar, not about me. I find that a lot of podcasts out there now are very centered on people's opinions. So I offer my opinion in the podcast occasionally, but I try to be relatively objective. So it changes a little bit when I'm the guest. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, a big reason, was a little bit of concern over what people would think. People, colleagues could listen to this and say, whoa, that's weird. I don't know how I feel about that. I got over that. And at some point I just said, I don't really care. I'm comfortable enough with myself. But one thing that helped me was, Eli, in one of our podcasts that we did together, you said to me in our 50th episode, do you think that it's a preconception that it's inauthentic to not share everything about yourself? And that helped me. I felt like a bit like a fraud by having a podcast called Preconceived and not talking about something that is so preconceived, obviously, and is a huge stigma and is completely in line with what this show's about, and not doing it. And your comment, Eli, helped me. I never really felt like, oh, I'm a fraud because I'm not talking about it. I should be open. I don't think that's how society should work. I don't think anybody's personal story is required to be told. I don't feel like I've done a disservice by not sharing it earlier.
One thing I'm curious about, part of what I wanted to try to do for myself in this conversation was get a deeper understanding of what it's like to experience OCD. Because the deepest way to understand something is through direct firsthand experience. And when you aren't able to experience something directly firsthand, the only avenue you really have is through some form of communication, whether it's somebody speaking it to you or you read about it. One thing I'm curious about is, do you think that someone who experiences OCD in a different form than you, so maybe different obsessive thoughts, different compulsions than the ones you experience, maybe if yours is centered on morality or significant decisions, theirs may be centered on hygiene. Do you think that they can understand your experience in a deep, intuitive way, and you can understand their experience in a deep, intuitive way because you both experience OCD? Or do different forms of OCD lead you to struggle to experience one another's state in the same way that Eric and I might struggle to experience yours?
That's such a good question. I watched, I'll go to Hollywood for this. I watched the movie The Aviator a couple years ago with my boy Leo, who I love. And to me, that's the best portrayal I've seen of OCD. He's playing Howard Hughes, and his becomes, amongst other things, focused on hygiene. And I remember watching it, especially in this one scene where he is doing this whole routine to ensure that he has not touched something, because he knows that if he touches one thing with his hand, he's going to have to do this whole hour routine again in order to get to a point where he feels like he's not contaminated. And then he accidentally touches something, and you see in his face, like, oh my God, the stress, because I know that now I have to do this all from the beginning. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, I totally feel that. I get that. Even though my OCD is never really centered on that, I understand that. It's similar to me when I would be doing my to-do list and then recalling it. And then at the very end of it, I would flick my hand to finish off the routine, and the hand flick wasn't sufficient. And I'd just be like, oh, damn it. And you feel this anxiety. I got to do it all over again. I got to do it all over again. And I felt that. So yeah, I do. It's because at the core of it is this feeling of anxiety. Like, there's moments when you just want to cry. Like, you just want to cry because you kind of do, because you don't know how to get past that anxiety. You just don't want to feel like that. I've done this routine so many times. I don't know what to do. And all I can really do, for me, is I'm going to call my mom and just be like, please, I can't. I've been going through this mental routine for 2 hours now, and I'm just so anxious, and I just need you to tell me it's okay. I need you to tell me I didn't do anything wrong, because if I don't get you to be the final authority on that, I'm just going to keep on going through this routine. I might get some relief for 10 minutes, but then it's going to come back. I just need that. And it's that sense of absolute pending doom, anxiety, headache, chest discomfort, all that stuff. So I do feel it.
Do you think it's also easier for someone who experiences a different form of anxiety, not OCD, maybe generalized anxiety or social anxiety, or someone who experiences another mental health thing like depression? Is it easier for someone with a different mental health experience to relate to somebody with OCD and vice versa? Or is it mostly just people with OCD can relate to and understand someone with OCD, even if it's a different form?
I think it's easier if it's the same diagnosis, to be honest. I think I can relate to somebody with OCD more than I can relate to somebody with something else. Having said that, I can probably relate to somebody with, I mean, I've had depression before, but I could probably relate to somebody with depression more so than the average person in the population, just because, given that I know a lot of people, most people can't understand what I'm going through, I probably have on some level a better sense of, I understand that I don't understand what that person's going through. Hmm. So I can feel for them a little bit more. But I think in terms of actually comparing the experience itself, no, I think it's probably fairly OCD specific. I think I might be more sensitive to somebody who's schizophrenic or to somebody who's bipolar in terms of my understanding that I don't understand what's going on there, but I know that they're suffering, but their experience is probably still pretty foreign to me, like my experience is foreign to you.
Cool. I love the way you said that. Very well articulated. So today, mental health has been dramatically destigmatized compared to even 5 years ago, 10 years ago. There's still room to go, but let's assume for a second that all mental health issues are completely 100% destigmatized in society. And anybody who has a negative reaction to it, they're like on the fringe. They're the outsiders. If I could snap my fingers and have everyone in your life know that you have OCD and that you have this experience, even if they can't directly understand it, would you want me to snap my fingers? Like, would you want everyone in your world to know that you have OCD?
There's times when I'll be in a conversation, and I've done this with you guys just because we're friends outside of this, where I'll preface in a serious conversation, but I know this is my OCD, and I'll kind of explain, I know this is related to my OCD, and I don't want to say use it as a crutch, but I'll use it as an explanation. And I've tried to do that less, because not because I feel like I'm using it as a crutch, but because, listen, labels are double-edged. I have the label of OCD, and that is good because that validates my experience to me and makes me feel less abnormal. And it makes me understand what's going on so that I can better treat it and address it. On the other hand, I have a label, and I could use that. And I probably have on some levels to, as an excuse for things. I've got OCD and, oh, it's okay. I just bothered you by calling you back and apologizing for something I didn't do. And I do that every time we have a conversation. That's okay. You should accept that because I have OCD. I have the label of OCD. I'm constantly asking you for reassurance. Well, you should just know I have OCD and that's part of it. And you're not sympathetic if you don't deal with that. That's not a society I want to live in. At the end of the day, we all need to be responsible for ourselves. So do I appreciate the extra empathy that some people give me? Sure. I think too much empathy would enable me. The other thing there is, I think it's a little bit disheartening for people who don't have those labels. If you're feeling anxious, you're feeling anxious. You might not have a diagnosis of OCD, but that doesn't make your experience of anxiety any less. But you can't say, I have OCD. And then you turn into this culture where you're anxious. Oh, but do you have an OCD label or do you have generalized anxiety disorder? No. Oh, then just get over it. And I think people would be very tempted to do that. If we're putting so much stock into the labels, then we start invalidating people's emotions who don't fit inside a label. But that's not the point of mental illness. You don't need a label. You don't need a psychiatric diagnosis to feel sad, to feel anxious, and to have people care for you. So at the end of the day, my diagnosis doesn't really matter. I need to deal with my life and be treated by friends the way I'd want to treat them if they have it or if they don't have it. And if I don't know.
Cool. I love that. Very, very insightful answer.
I don't even know where we go from there. That seemed like a good mic drop.
I have another, a total pivot type question. You mentioned that you view OCD as treatable, but not curable. Currently, cancer is treatable, but not curable. Do you believe that one day cancer could be cured?
I mean, I think there are certain types of cancers that are curable.
Cool. Do you so let's zoom out and make it a broad question. Do you think there is a future state where all cancer can be cured? Do you believe that's a possibility? And if so, how likely do you see that future?
Yeah, I do. I do think there's a situation one day where science will be able to cure cancer.
So do you think that obsessive compulsive disorder could one day be curable and just today is treatable?
That's the tough thing. It's so hard. On the one hand, I want to say, well, it's a medical thing. It's a medical diagnosis. So it should be curable the same way that it is with that cancer or diabetes should be curable one day. We should be able to cure them. But it's just so intertwined, mental health, with the normal human experience, right? So the normal human experience, no. The troubles and tribulations and the struggles we all have, that is never going to be cured. Unfortunately, and maybe fortunately, because that's what gives us depth, that is life. So that's never going to be cured. Is it possible that we could better cure, I guess, the way my thought patterns work? Possibly, but everybody experiences anxiety at some point, right?
Yeah.
My propensity towards experiencing anxiety is higher than the average person's. If you're going to say cure it, I guess I don't have an answer. On some level, yeah, because I do believe it's strongly biological, but I also believe it's a biological hyper-exaggeration of normal human experience. And normal human experience is always going to include anxiety and depression, and there's always going to be a spectrum there. So I do believe strongly this is obviously biological, but it's also shaped by just who I am and my general predisposition. And so to say the cure that doesn't really jive.
Hmm. All right. Interesting. Because in my sort of curiosities about it, I've tried to understand a little bit of the neurobiological underpinnings of it. And it does occur to me that there is a neurobiology that exists as the foundation of obsessive compulsive disorder. And a large part of it may exist in areas of the brain that we haven't really understood deeply yet. And as a result, we can't say that there are things we could do to adapt that neurobiology in order to fix it. But I mean, it occurs to me as maybe something that could be cured one day down the road, but
100%.
We don't know.
And maybe I want to revise what I said, because I read this study of somebody who had ketamine for OCD and their symptoms went away. Like they reported, this is just one case study, but they went away completely for 2 weeks and their mind just felt completely normal. And I can understand what that means. So maybe what I'm saying is yes, because I do strongly, my message is not that this is not biological. This is absolutely biological, but any psychiatric illness I do believe is shaped more by general societal and human factors than certain other diseases. My point is, I do think there's a possibility for a cure, but do I think there's a possibility to alleviate all anxiety and depression, which on some level are on the same scale as these disorders? No.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have one final, this is a lighter question to maybe wrap it up with.
Well, then wait, one more dark question.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. It's not that dark.
Not again, because I haven't said anything like this. For the first time, I used to have a lot of what you're describing as OCD rituals or tendencies when I was a kid. I can go into a couple examples, because I think back to the things I used to do as a kid, and I was never diagnosed, but I don't know what else they could be described as, other than what you're describing OCD to be. I had things where, like, I would have rituals with light dimmers. I would have questions that I would ask my parents every single night before I went to sleep. I wouldn't walk on the cracks in the sidewalk, all for the reasons of, if I didn't do those things, something bad would happen. Mm-hmm. And now I don't have those things. So what do you know about that for someone like me who had these things that I had to do the same way of the same, not the same manifestations, but similar to your rituals. And now I don't have to do these rituals anymore, but I've never been treated. What's that all about?
So I think there's two parts there. One is it possible for it to go away? I don't know. You'd have to speak to a psychologist, psychiatrist for that. I don't know. I would say for really advanced cases, I don't think it's common that happens, that you just fall out of it. Mm-hmm. The second element there is, okay, so a lot of people listening to this are probably saying, yeah, I've had things like that too. Do I have OCD? Did I have OCD? And then it just went away. Mm-hmm. And again, this is the issue with labels. Did you meet the diagnostic criteria for OCD? Probably not, because it wasn't having a significant enough impact on your life. Does that mean that you were having OCD-like tendencies? For sure. Sounds like you were having OCD-like tendencies. And a lot of people listening to this probably do have OCD-like tendencies or did have OCD-like tendencies. And again, the problem with labels is just because you don't have OCD doesn't mean that wasn't causing you anxiety. It's not to invalidate your experience. On the one hand, it's good that people have those experiences because they can relate to people with OCD and they can relate to people with depression because, oh, I've had sadness before. And that's a good thing that you can relate to that experience.
Right.
And your experiences should be validated. The other side of it is that people who don't have these conditions medically diagnosed, there might be a tendency for them to say, oh, I fully get it and I got over it. Why don't you get over it? And to not actually understand OCD or depression. So the more relatable I think something is for people, the more relatable it is to just general human experience. You can either say, okay, I get it and I can empathize with you. Or there's the risk that people say, oh, I get it, but I'm fine. Why don't you just get over it too?
Right. Yeah. Another good mic drop moment. But Eli, you had something fun to talk about. Let's go to that.
Well, it's not fun. It's just a lighter question. I'm just curious if you've ever thought about this. I have noticed a pattern when people speak about obsessive compulsive disorder. And this is predominantly when people who are not deeply knowledgeable either by studying it or by experiencing it. This is that category of people. They will often say, I am OCD, as opposed to I have OCD. And if you expand the acronym, that's saying I am obsessive compulsive disorder, not I have obsessive compulsive disorder. Does that bother you?
It bothers me.
It doesn't bother me at all. And I've been asked that before. I've more so been asked that in the context of, do people just throwing around the word OCD bother you? It doesn't bother me. But you could say that about so many things in society. Like, there's so many words we're constantly readjusting because they've suddenly become insensitive because they've been overused. And I'm not trying to sound insensitive to those words that have been replaced, but I don't have an issue with that. I get what people are saying. It's just common vernacular. People say I'm OCD. Maybe they actually do have OCD and they are saying that I have OCD, or maybe they're just saying I'm OCD, like my personality has OCD-like tendencies. Not to mention there's another condition called obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is different, which just speaks to somebody's personality.
Ooh, we got a part three coming to the podcast.
Which we won't get into. But my point is, it doesn't bother me. I think it might bother some people. To me, I get what they're saying. I understand. We know what they mean. I don't think anybody's being insensitive to people who are struggling with OCD.
It bothers me grammatically, but aside from the grammar faux pas, I hear what you're saying, and I think that makes a lot of sense.
It bothers Eli grammatically, and it bothers Eric dramatically.
Guys, thank you so much for hosting this episode. I was hesitant to do this, but I think we dug a bit deeper into the weeds, because my sister who was interviewing me, she's grown up with me with OCD, and she's been a huge confidant in my life. So there's a lot of things that she probably takes for granted because she knows it so well, whereas you guys might represent a greater portion of the audience that hasn't grown up with that and doesn't have that experience. So I think this led to productive and good conversation. And next week we'll be back to an episode that has nothing to do with me. I don't know what that is yet, but I'm excited for that. So anyway, Eli and Eric, thank you so much. Much appreciated. You guys are great.
Excited to come back and see what we dive into next time.
Absolutely.
We love you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, guys. And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. If you're liking the show, rate and review us. It takes 5 seconds. Go to your podcast app, click 5 stars, and that will make my day. And Eric and Eli's too. Have a great day. Bye.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.